Many years ago, I heard a speech by a shul rabbi from the United States who made the following comment. He said that he was once having, as a rabbi in a small community someplace, I don't even remember where, small Jewish community, who said that he had, as the rabbi of a small shul in a small community, he had forged relationships with religious leaders, the local ministers, and things of that nature. And he said that the minister, the local Protestant minister, once commented to him, you know, Rabbi, I'm very jealous of you. He said, why? The minister said, well, you know, we clergymen are often asked to, give a, what's it called, a convocation or something, invocation, whatever it is. You know, they ask me all kinds of public events and I have to speak, and I never know what to say. It's always hard to figure out what to say. But you have this Parsha thing. No matter what's going on, you always have something you can talk about. And that comment struck with me because, first of all, it says something about the wisdom of the institution of Parshat HaShavua and Kriyat HaTorah, which goes back to Ezra HaSofer, the idea that, you know, all of the Jewish people studies the same Parsha every week, all the time. And every good darshan, every good rabbi has to know how to connect the Parsha to whatever's going on in the world, and this week's bar mitzvah boy, and the couple that just got married, all in the same speech. And that's the art of a drasha. Sometimes it works out easier than others. I couldn't have asked for anything better than I got this morning. Because I opened up the news this morning to find out that it looks like we're having elections in a few months, and I was about to talk about politics. So how could it be any more fitting than that? But apparently, although I don't think it's official yet, but it looks like apparently that we're going to be having elections in a few months. And whenever there is elections in this country, I think pretty much every single time that we've had elections, whatever other issues there are, the nature of Israeli reality is such that usually the single most important issue in the election, and oftentimes the only real issue in the election, is security and military policy. I think in the past couple of elections there's been a little bit of a turn, probably very thankfully so, a little bit of a turn towards being able to think about other things, socioeconomic policy. But still, the bottom line is, the question of peace negotiations, yes, no, and all these type of things are always the top of the agenda. And it's safe to assume that that will be the case in this coming election as well. In Israeli politics, they like to divide it, broadly speaking, into two camps, what are usually called in Israel, although I'm not sure that this is really the correct political science term, but it's usually called right wing and left wing. Often we all are familiar with this, but let's just define these terms, because it's really what we're going to talk about in the shiur today. You know, in a sort of broad strokes, you know, the right wing political viewpoint advocates kind of a hardline, uncompromising stance confronting our enemies. Willingness to take military action when necessary, very, very much reluctance to any sort of diplomatic compromise, standing up for our rights and, you know, fighting for them diplomatically, fighting for them militarily, etc. And the left-wing approach generally emphasizes willingness to compromise and to negotiate, and diplomacy over military action, a willingness even to concede, or sometimes the term painful compromises is used, and things of that nature. If you look back at every election, certainly every election I've ever had the opportunity to vote in, those have been, the details are different. At one point it was the Gaza disengagement plan, at one point it was should we leave Lebanon, but these are just details in one big debate. If you know anything about modern history, this has been the argument in every election since 1948, and it's been the argument long before 1948. If you go back to the early 20th century, if it goes back to the disputes between the Haganah versus the Lehi and the Etzel, or Begin and Ben-Gurion, if you want, or Jabotinsky, Herzl, however you want to look at it. But the truth is, these debates go much further than that. And these debates are not limited only to contemporary Israeli reality or to even the 19th and 20th century. These debates can be found in the Rishonim. These debates can be found in Chazal. And ultimately, I believe these debates can be found in the Torah itself, particularly in this week's Parsha. And that's what I want to try to show you. Now, when you talk about politics, you have to kind of make a certain, I feel I have to make a certain disclaimer. We all have our political opinions, and I have mine. probably won't surprise anyone, but I'm fairly right-wing politically. And, you know, in this country there are certain groups that feel that all political decisions should be made by rabbis. There are political parties who define as their policy that all decisions are made by a Muetzet Chachmei Torah, or whatever it's called. Perhaps in reaction to that, there are also people, I've heard many people, both here and in Chutz La'aretz, voice the opinion that rabbis should never get involved in politics. Rabbis shouldn't speak about politics. Rabbis should stick to religion and let politics, leave politics to the politicians or the lay people or whatever the story is. Personally, my feeling is that rabbis have certainly the right, and I think perhaps even the responsibility, to express political opinions. But I also think it's important, and this is the reason I'm saying this right now, is that I think a rabbi needs to differentiate between his personal political opinion and the Torah. Meaning it's perfectly legitimate for a rabbi to have a political position, but I don't think it's legitimate to present that as the Torah's position, or certainly not the Torah's only, or the only Torah position. Because what I want to try to show you today is that both positions, in broad strokes, both the so-called right-wing and the so-called left-wing position, have a basis in the Torah, which means that both sides ultimately can point to the Torah as proof, which means that in the end we're going to have to come back and debate the politics of the matter. But I believe it's still instructive anyway. And let's take a look. There's actually two separate places in this, both in this week's parsha, where I think you see the political debate between right-wing and left-wing. Again, both in the Torah itself, and in the way in which these two sections of the parsha were interpreted by later authorities. So let's start with the first one. We spoke last week about Yaakov's time with Lavan. We'll make reference to what we said last week in a minute as well. But this week's parsha begins with Yaakov having already left Lavan and had his confrontation with Lavan at the end of last week's parsha and sort of settled that, made a treaty with Lavan, put up that pile of stones, that monument, Gal Eid, or Yigar Sahaduta, as Lavan called it in Aramaic. His problems with Lavan assumably are behind him, but the bigger challenge lies ahead. He knows that, remember, Esav had once upon a time threatened to kill him. And it was for that reason that he had to run away, and it's been 20 years. And now it's time to come home. And he's coming home. He's responsible now. He left, as he himself said, B'makli avarti et hayarden hazeh. He left as a single person, responsible only for himself, and now he's the head of a large family, a clan, if you will, four wives, at least 12 children, perhaps more children. According to Chazal, there were also twin daughters born with each of the sons. And he's got a lot of wealth, so that there's also property to be protected or property to attract the potential confrontation, and he's concerned. And the beginning of the parsha discusses Yaakov's preparations. And Rashi quotes from Chazal. Hey, well, you know what? Let's read first the Psukim. I'll read from the beginning of the parsha. Vayishlach Yaakov malachim lefanav el Esav achiv aretz ha-seir sedei adom. He is approaching Eretz Yisrael. Esav is in Har Seir, which is near Eretz Yisrael. He's approaching the general vicinity. He sends messengers ahead to Esav. He sends a messenger in proper diplomatic niceties. He refers to himself as Avdecha Yaakov, your humble servant. And he gives him the message in Lavan Garti, Va'ichar ad Ata, Va'hili Shor, V'chamor, Tzon, V'evid, V'shivcha, V'eshlecha Lagid Ladoni, Limtzochein Be'enecha. I've been away for a while. I've been with Lavan for 20 years. In the meantime, he speaks in Esav's terms, he speaks mainly about his possessions. I've become wealthy, I have lots of animals and servants, and I'm sending this message, Limtzochein Beinecha. It's a message of peace. I want to reconcile our differences. Vayashuvu amalachim. So that might be seen as what we would call today a trial balloon or something of that nature, right? He wants to see which way the wind is blowing. Vayashuvu amalachim el Yaakov. Lemar, they came back. Banu el achicha el Esav, v'gam holech lukratcha, v'arbame ot ish imo. They said we went to meet Esav. The truth is we didn't have to go all the way to Har Seir. We met him on the way. He's coming to meet you. Oh, very nice. He's coming to meet me, and he has 400 men with him. Okay, if you read Sefer Bereishit carefully, it's clear 400 men was a military unit. Abraham took 400 men when he went to go fight. 400 men is a pluga. And they're all men. He's coming with soldiers. He's coming with an army, small army, which probably does not bode well. He wasn't coming with musicians and a welcoming party, and he was coming with 400 armed men. Vayira Yaakov ma'od vayetzelo. And the Torah tells us very clearly that Yaakov became afraid. And then the Torah tells us what he did. In a minute we'll read Rashi's analysis. Let's just read what he did first. First, vayachatz et ha'am asher ito, v'tatzon v'tabakar v'tagmalim l'shnei machanot. He divided everybody, all of his family members and all the property and all the servants into two camps. Why? Vayomrim yavoi sadel ha'machane ha'achat v'hikahu vayah ha'machane ha'nish'ar lifleita. In case Esav comes and attacks, he wants to divide his people into two separate groups so that one could escape, one half could escape in case something should remain. Vayomer Yaakov, Elohei Avi Abraham, Elohei Avi Yitzchak, Adonai ha'omer elai shuv la'artzecha u'lemodai yitzchak ve'tiv ha'imach. He begins to pray. He addresses Hashem. Maybe we'll skip all the lengthy tefillah, but Persuk Yudbet puts it on the table. What he says to Hashem is, Hatzileni na. Miyad achim, miyad esav, ki yarei anochi oto, pen yavov, hikani, eim al banim. He says very honestly what his fear is. He says it straight. Save me from my brother, from Esav. I am afraid that he's going to come and kill everybody. And after that, Pasuk Yudalet, Vayalim sham balayla hahu, vayikach min habav yadom mincha le'esav achiv. Izim matayim, chasim etzrim, mechilim matayim, elim etzrim, gmalim enikot, v'nehem shloshim. He gathers a large group of animals, 200 of this, and 20 of that, and 30 of this. Vayitain biyad avadav, eider, eider livado. And he organizes this large collection of animals in groups, in a very dramatic way, one after the other, and he sends them. He sets up, it's odd, Esav is coming with a military camp, and instead of putting armed guards in the front, he has this long procession of animals, a whole group of camels, and a whole group of goats, and a whole group with space in between, this like parade. Esav's coming with armed men, and he has this collection of, not horses, which are used for fighting, but all these other animals. And he tells the leader of the first group, he tells the messenger ahead of the first group of animals, right? This is an odd scene. Esav's coming with a military company, ready for battle, and he sees Yaakov way back there in the distance, and there's groups of animals, and there's a guy coming with a bunch of, it doesn't say which ones, but let's say with a bunch of goats. So he's going to ask you, who are you? What is all this? So he tells him what to respond. Amarta le'avdecha le'Yaakov, mincha hi shlucha l'adoni le'esav, v'hine gam hu acharim. You're to tell him, we represent Yaakov, calling him again, avdecha Yaakov, and this is a mincha, this is a gift for you, and he is coming as well. V'etzav gam et hasheni, v'gam et hashlishi, gam et kol ha'luchim. And they're all supposed to say the same thing, each one when they get. And he told them, each one of them, to tell the same thing again and again and again. Here's more gifts and more gifts and more gifts. And he says that each one should tell him, this is from Yaakov, and this is from Yaakov, and this is from Yaakov. Ki amar achapra fanav. Yaakov wants you to know that he wants to make good, he wants to appease you. He wants to put our differences behind us. B'mincha ha'holecha defanai, v'achareichein ere panav, ulai yisa panai. Maybe, 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 he will be appeased. So if you go back to Rashi, those who have Rashi, if not, it's just one line, I'll read it. Well-known Rashi. Rashi analyzes what we just read. Rashi on v'haya ha'machane ha'nisha l'preta. Rashi says, hitkin atzmo l'shlosha dvarim, l'doron, l'tfila, u'lemilchama. He prepared himself in three ways. Doron, he offered gifts, what one might even call a bribe. Tfilah, he prayed to God. And milchama, and he took practical steps for military confrontation, primarily defensive steps. He divided into two camps, but that means he was preparing for war. Lidoron, Rashi tells you, Batavor minchal, panav, litfila, he prayed in milchama, vaya machanen nishadefeta. So essentially, if we would have, maybe I should have done it this way, if I would have paused back before I told you all this, if we would have just read that Yaakov heard that Esav's coming with 400 men, pause button, and open up the diun and discussion, what should Yaakov do? Let's advise him, what should he do? So I don't know what the people in this room would say. But the right-wing camp, as it were, would respond with one approach, and the left-wing camp would respond with another approach. Which of the two did Yaakov follow? Both. He prepared for milchama, right? The right-wingers would say, you know, get ready. And if he has more men than you, then let's figure out, let's use our Israeli ingenuity, you know, let's pull off another milchama cheshit ayamim, let's figure it out, that's how we're going to, you know, use our better technology or our better strategy, something. And the left-wing camp would say diplomacy and negotiations, and, you know, let's try to see if we can work out a diplomatic arrangement. And Yaakov, according to this midrash, adopted both approaches. He prepared for Doron and he prepared for milchama. And a third thing that Yaakov did that perhaps both camps could perhaps agree on. Even if you feel that we need to use milchama, or even if you feel that we need to use doron, perhaps they both could agree that it should be accompanied by tefillah. So Yaakov used all three approaches. So if that's the case, was Yaakov right wing or left wing? He seems to have been trying to work on both tracks. Right, and contemporary, politician would say the military option is still on the table. You know, we haven't closed any diplomatic doors or anything like that. Right, so fine, the military option is on the table. Diplomacy, we're trying to exhaust all diplomatic actions. But usually, when a politician speaks, you're able to tell: are we exhausting all diplomatic actions just for the sake of having an excuse to do what we really want, which is the military action, or are we claiming the military action's on the table, but really we're just going to continue with diplomacy? What's Yaakov's ultimate decision? Is he a right winger or a left winger? I think it's very clear. You think he's right wing? I think he's left wing. Why do you say?
That's what he did first.
That's what he did first. Not only first.
He made like a backup plan, but that was his main thing.
I think it's clear. Why do you say he's a right wing?
Because I know he wants his. Separate from him. I don't know.
Separation today is part of the left-wing lexicon,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
All defense. No, but my point is this. My point is that Yaakov, it's clear that to Yaakov, the military option was the backup plan.
That's the last.
Right? Which means maybe in today's terminology we should call him moderate left-wing. Yeah. Right? He's not one of those people who says, I'm trying very hard to be neutral and to be objective. He's not one of those people who says, you know, war is never justified, and we always have to. He understands that there's a need for. But it's clear that Yaakov prefers a diplomatic solution, even one that requires certain forms of concessions. And look how this winds up. Eventually, he comes to Esav. We'll skip the dramatic confrontation with the Malach, which maybe we'll have time to come back to at the end. But in any case, Perek Lamed Gimel says, "Vayisa Yaakov." It was now the next morning, after the dramatic confrontation at night. "Vayisa Yaakov einav, vayar v'hine Esav ba v'imo arba miotish." Again, he sees that Esav's coming, and indeed, he sees now with his own eyes the company of 400 men. "Vayachatz et hayiladim al Leah v'al Rachel v'al shtei shvachot." He divides now his family. Between, he has Leah and her children, and Rachel and her children, and the Shvachot. Vayasim et haShvachot ve'et yaldehen rishona. First, he places the Zilpah and Bilhah and their children. Ve'et Leah ve'et yaladeha acharonim. Ve'et Rachel ve'et Yosef acharonim. Rachel at this point only has one child. Binyamin is yet to be born. Ve'hu avar lifneihem. And he goes in front of all of them. Vayishtachu arza sheva pe'amim. He bows to Esav 7 times. Ad gishto arachiv. And Esav, Vayarat Esav Likrato, Vayichabkehu, Vayipol al Tzavara, Vayishakehu, Vayivku. Esav comes in this very dramatic scene. He hugs him, he kisses him. There's dots over the word Vayishakehu. He kissed him. In biblical text, when there are dots over a word, that's the equivalent of, notation, it would mean the equivalent of parentheses or italics. It's meant to set the word off. It means something. And Rashi quotes here as well, Midrash Chazal. You know, the word Vayishakeyu, that Esav kissed him, is being emphasized in the written text. It's bolded, it's italics, whatever term you want to use. Rashi says, Nakod alav v'yesh cholkim badavar. There's two interpretations of what those dots over the word he kissed him means. Yesh darshu nikuda zo lomar shelo nashko b'chol libo. One opinion is that it's telling you that Esav didn't really mean it. He went through the diplomatic niceties, but this was not sincere at all. So he kissed him, but the word kissed is sort of highlighted to show you that don't take it too seriously. That's one approach. But the other approach, Amar Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, halacha hi biyadua she'esav sonei li Yaakov, ela shenichmiru rachamav ba'ota sha'a u'neshako b'chol libo. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai has the opposite approach. It's known fact. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai even uses the word halacha. She'esav sonei li Yaakov. And if I have time at the end of the shiur, I'll return to that point as well. Halacha hi she'esav sonei li Yaakov. But this time, for this moment, Esav was filled with genuine emotion, and for a brief moment, it actually was sincere, and that's why the word is emphasized. So there's two approaches to understanding Esav's motivation. Was he genuinely and sincerely appeased? So says Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, but only for a moment. Later on, Esav's going to return to his old self. Or was this also part of some sort of calculated move that for whatever reason Esav decided he's not going to attack or not going to attack now? But one way or another, okay, Yaakov bowed to Esav, and at least in the short term he achieved the result, the desired result. Esav did not attack. They have this brief conversation. And then, Vatigashna Shfachot Heina V'yaldehen Vatishtachavena. So then he brings his family. And first, Bilhah and Zilpah, their children, right? That's Gad and Asher and Dan and Naphtali, bowed down to Esav. Vadikash gam le'avi ladeha, Reuven, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, all bowed down. Vayishtachavu, v'achar nigash Yosef v'Rachel, vayishtachavu. Yaakov is willing to have his entire family bow to Esav and to give all these gifts of appeasement to avoid a military confrontation. And that's a concession, one would think. Now, to some extent, we have to go back to the shiur we had last week. Last week we spoke about the question of two approaches to understand 2 weeks ago's parsha, what Yaakov did with Yitzchak, and whether we should view what happened to him with Lavan as a punishment for what he had done or not. Perhaps that might have some bearing on this. And if Yaakov felt a certain amount of guilt, felt that he was wrong, then maybe that has some bearing on the way he interacts with Esav. Although, as we pointed out last week, if he did something wrong, it was probably something he did wrong to Yitzchak. With Esav, it's not so clear that he actually wronged Esav. But in any case, perhaps that has something to do with it. But it seems clear to me that Yaakov is willing to bow, to make material concessions. He gave up a significant amount of property and symbolic concessions. He's presenting himself he's calling himself Abdecha. He's saying, I want to appease you. He's sort of apologizing, accepting guilt, and he's having everyone bow to Esav. Now perhaps I should have, I meant to at the outset also make one other clarification. When we talk about right-wing and left-wing approaches, and those that are in favor of a more militant approach and those who are in favor of a more concessionary approach. First of all, I assume it's clear there are, of course, numerous gradations and variations within each camp. But there's also in each camp, two fundamental subdivisions. In other words, one can one can represent a right-wing approach for one of two reasons, and one can represent a left-wing approach for one of two reasons. And sometimes the two go together, but they're still two separate types of claims. On the one hand, one can advocate whatever approach she's advocating for ideological reasons or for practical reasons. Meaning, just to translate it into contemporary realities, right? If somebody would be in favor of establishing a Palestinian state in the Yehuda Shomron, or if someone would be opposed to such a thing. So there are ideologies that can be, you know, that can be harnessed on either side. One can say, you know, I'm morally opposed to the occupation, and therefore on moral grounds, it's wrong for us to be occupying Yehuda Shomron, and therefore we have to allow a Palestinian state. And the right-wing opponent can argue we can't give up an inch no matter what happens, because whether it's a religious ideology of this is the land that was promised to us by God, or a secular version of nationalist ideology that this is our ancestral homeland and we have to be willing to fight to the last drop of blood, so that debate can take place on ideological grounds or on practical grounds. One can come along and say, listen, maybe I even agree ideologically that we should have a right-wing approach, but for the sake of peace, I'm willing to give up something that not only do I not agree that it's wrong to be occupying Yehuda Shomron, I think it's wrong to give it up, but I'd rather do that than enter into what I believe is going to be an endless state of war, and therefore I'm willing to compromise on an ideological principle for the sake of what I think is going to result in peace or saving lives. And the other side could also be true. The other side could say, you know what, I feel bad occupying Palestinian territory, but I realize what happened. Look what we did in Gaza, and look what happened with Hamas, and the only way to have security is for us to rule the territory, even if I don't like it. Or you can obviously have both together. You can defend the particular position ideologically or practically or both, but the points are different. It's clear here that Yaakov prefers the concessions, prefers, being apologetic and humbling himself before Esau, prefers that to a military confrontation. It's not 100% clear to me, at least, whether he does this on moral grounds because he really feels guilty and really believes that Esau is right, or whether he's I remember when Yitzhak Rabin signed the first treaty with Yasser Arafat on the White House lawn. I remember watching it on television. I think it was clear to everyone when you saw Rabin shake Arafat's hand. It was so clear that he was disgusted by what he was doing. Right or wrong, he believed that he had to do it, but not because he, you know, felt that he was making peace with a genuine, you know, person who was wronged. He felt he was dealing with a bloodthirsty terrorist, and he felt that this is what he had to do. So it's not clear whether that's how Yaakov felt. Not clear to me, at least. Maybe if someone here, you know, has an indication in the text, you know, please bring it up. I don't see an indication whether Yaakov was feeling, you know, I can't believe I'm doing this, and, you know, gritting his teeth, but feeling that this was the lesser of two evils, or whether he genuinely, or maybe we should put it this way. Esav kissed Yaakov, and we saw in Chazal two interpretations of what Esav was thinking. Could there also be two? Could we put dots over the word vayishtachaveh and say whether Yaakov meant it or didn't mean it? I'm not sure. But it's clear to me one way or the other. I'm not sure in this incident. We'll get into a minute in the second incident there. I think it's a little more clear, but we'll see. There's actually a debate about it, we'll see. But in this case, at least, it seems clear to me that Yaakov prefers diplomacy, prefers an agreement, even involving concessions, perhaps painful concessions, rather than a military confrontation.
And you don't think it was because if it were military, he would lose?
It might be. Mm-hmm. Someone, if his objection was practical and not ideological, so then it could very well be that a person who... That's probably the difference between someone who has an ideological approach and someone who's a practical approach. You know, someone who's against a Palestinian state for ideological reasons is going to be against it no matter what. Someone who's in favor of a Palestinian state for moral ideological reasons is going to be in favor no matter what. But someone who takes those positions because their reading of the political, geopolitical, military, whatever it is, map can definitely change. Right? They could say, I thought that way once, but now things are different. The second incident where I think we see Yaakov maintaining the exact same philosophy, but others feeling differently, is the incident with Dinah later in the parsha. Let's take a look. So this is in Perek Lamed Dalet. Let's read from the beginning. Perek Lamed Dalet, that would say, Dina bat Lea, asher yarda Yaakov lirot bivnot haaretz, vayar ota Shechem ben Hamor hachivi nesi aretz, vayikach ota, vayishkav ota, vayeaneha. Okay, Dina bat Yaakov, went out, whatever that means, discussion what that means, but she apparently was in a vulnerable situation, and Shechem ben Hamor, who's the son of the ruler of the city of Shechem, goes out and he grabs her and rapes her. Violent kidnapping and rape. Vatidbak nafsho bedina bat Yaakov vayehave tenara vaydeber levanar, and he wants to keep her, wants to marry her. Vayomer Shechem el Hamor aviv lemor kachli et hayalda hazot liisha. We see how much he definitely how much he respected her, right? This girl, child, yalda, right? Not even nara, yalda. And then it says, and this next pasuk is important. V'Yaakov shama ki timei et dinavito uvanav hayu et miknehu basadeh v'hecherish Yaakov ad boam. So first of all, lest we think in the coming pasukim that perhaps Yaakov was unaware of what had happened, that is not the case. The Torah makes clear, v'yishma Yaakov. Yaakov knew exactly what happened. And the expression, ki timei et dinah, they defiled dinah. And Yaakov remained silent. Vayetzei Chamor av Yishchem el Yaakov ledaber ito. Chamor, the father of Shechem, wants to perhaps give his child what he wants. And this is a different shir, so we won't go into it, but it seems that there were also political / economic considerations. He wants to try to use this event as an opportunity to enter into some kind of a treaty with Yaakov, a marriage between two tribes type of thing. And that's what he proposes. Uvnei Yaakov ba'u min ha-sadeh kishamam, v'yit'atzvu ha-anashim, v'yichar lehem me'od, ki nivala asa b'Yisrael ishkavet bat Yaakov, v'chein lo ye'aseh. It says that Yaakov's sons, when they came back, also heard what happened, and they were also very angry. Now, Yaakov heard that Dinah was defiled, and the sons also heard that a nivala was done, a disgusting thing, something v'chein lo ye'aseh, something that's not done, or should not be done. So it seems that there's no difference between Yaakov and his children in terms of their evaluation of what happened here. A terrible thing has been done to their family. And by the way, Dinah is still there. She's a captive. It's clear that she's only rescued later. It's not like they came and said, okay, we're giving her back. Sorry for whatever happened, but now we'd like to arrange a marriage. These discussions or negotiations about a potential marriage are taking place while Dinah is a captive. So both Yaakov and his sons seem to agree that they're in a bad situation, that something terrible has been done. And Chamor comes to make a proposal. Vaydaber Chamor itam lemor, Shechem b'ni chashka nafsho b'vitchem, tnu na ota lo li'isha, v'yitchatnu otanu, b'notenu titnu lana, v'p'notenu tikhu lachem, v'yitanu teshevu v'aretz teya lefnechem, shvu uscharuha, v'achazuba. There's a diplomatic economic component to this also. Let's arrange this marriage and we'll become like one big tribe, and your daughter will marry my son and you'll live with us and we'll do trade with one another and you can settle here, etc. And of course we know what happened. Yaakov, by the way, doesn't respond. His children speak on his behalf. Vayanu pasuk yigimu, vayanu v'nei Yaakov et Shechem v'et Chamor avi bin Mirma. That's a word we saw last week, right? They used the same technique, the same word that Yaakov had used against Yitzchak and Lavan had used against Yaakov. Lama rimitani, right? Ba'achicha bin Mirma vayikach birchatecha. They also use a ruse. They use deception. And why do they use this deception? Asher timeh dinachotam. They feel justified in doing this because Shechem and his son have acted in unethically and continue to act unethically. Again, it's not like they gave Dinah back and now are trying to, they're conducting these, they're talking as if they, you know, coming with a proposal, but in the meantime they're holding her captive. So Yaakov's children felt justified in using deception, And as we know, they made this proposal. Listen, we like your proposal. We want to do it. We just have this thing. You know, we have this custom of Brit Milah. If you want to intermarry with our family, the whole city is going to have to undergo a circumcision. And they did that in order to weaken them. And as you know, of course, the ruse was actually successful. It worked. And Shechem and his son actually convinced the entire city to undergo circumcision. And then we get to Pasuk Chafei Vahi Vayoma Shlishi Biyotam Koavim. While on the third day, when they were in their weakest state, recovering from this, surgical procedure, taking advantage of that physical weakness, Vayikchu Shnei Vnei Yaakov Shimon V'Levi Achei Dina Ish Charbo Vayavo Alhir Betach Vayahargu Kol Zachar. They didn't just use this opportunity to rescue Dina. They went much further than that. They went into the city or the village and they massacred, is that the word we want to use? Or maybe that's too loaded of a word. They killed all the men in the city. including Chamor, the one who had raped Dina and his father. I'm sorry, Shechem and his father, Chamor. Beseder. Vayikhu et Dina mi Beit Shechem. So here we see that she was still there. They killed the entire city, at least all the men in the city, including Shechem and Chamor, and they took Dina from her captivity, Vayetzeyu, and they went out. And everything else, that Sonam, that Bekaram, that Chamorehem, that Kol Asher Bayir, that Kol Asher Basadel Lakachu, that Kol Chilam, that Kol Tapam, that Nishayim Shabu, Vayavozu, that Kol Asher Babayit. They killed all the men and everything else. The animals, all the property, and the women and children being taken as slaves, everything was taken as spoils of war. They simply eradicated the entire city and took whatever was left as spoils of war. And now we have a brief debate between Yaakov and his children, and Shimon Levi in particular. Vayomer Yaakov el Shimon ve'el Levi, achartem oti lahav isheni biyoshev haaretz bakena'ani uvaprizi, v'ani mitei mispar v'ne'esfu alai v'hikuni v'nishmarati ani uveti. He said, achartem oti lahav isheni, you've done something very dangerous. You've done something that's going to have, that may have drastic and horrific ramifications. Because what's going on here? Yes, you managed through using trickery to induce the entire population of this city into a weakened state so that you were able to defeat this city. But where's your long-term vision? We're still alone here, and we're surrounded by Knani Uprizi, Va'ani Mitei Mispar. We're just one family. And we're surrounded by entire nations. V'nesfu alai v'hikuni v'nishmarati uveti. You have now endangered the entire family. I'm afraid that the entire nations, all the cities in the area are going to hear what happened and they're going to come and attack all of us and we have no chance. And what does Shimon v'Levi respond? Vayomru, they respond with four words. Hakizona ya'aseh et achotenu. Shall we simply allow her to be treated like a common prostitute? So first of all, do you agree with me that Shimon v'Levi are right wing and Yaakov is left wing? Right? Yaakov maintains his approach. Shimon v'Levi are right wing for ideological reasons or for practical reasons?
Maybe Yaakov is just more mature. And he's able to look at the long term. We know that younger people are often more hot-headed and just see what's in front of their face. And older people sometimes have a more of a perspective. But even ideology.
Well, or you could say that when they were younger, they had one ideology, and the maturity of age gave them a different ideology. Meaning, it certainly could be. Listen, Yaakov would not be the first person who was a right winger in his youth, and when he got older, turned more left wing. Although Israeli politics has seen the opposite as well. But it certainly may be. But still, all I'm saying is that Shimon Velevi's approach is what we would call today a right-wing approach, right? They responded with a reprisal attack, with a, there's another word besides reprisal, with a, retaliation. They retaliated, right? And Yaakov is saying that that was a very bad thing to do. Shimon Velevi's justification for their actions is ideological or practical? It sounds ideological. And Yaakov's response? Is his objection ideological or practical? It sounds like it's practical. He's saying, look, you know, you've just endangered us. We're not, you know, like Eileen said before, you know, maybe he simply felt militarily he didn't have the, it could be, right? And it could be that maybe this can shed some light on what he was thinking just a few weeks earlier when he met Esav, right? He felt that he didn't have the military strength to confront Esav. He has to make concessions. He doesn't think he has the military strength to face the nations of Canaan. And even though Shimon and Levi thought they did have the military strength, they're looking at the little picture here, like you're mentioning, maybe, but he has a bigger thing. He's thinking about the day after, and he's thinking about what's going to happen when the rest of the country hears about it, etc. So here it sounds like his objection, meaning it sounds like he's not morally opposed to what they did, he just thinks that it's politically dangerous. However, at the end of Sefer Bereishit, we get a different message. And perhaps when we get to Parsha Vayechi, I'm thinking maybe we'll talk about that next year, that week too, I'm not sure. But if you just take a quick peek now, in Parsha Vayechi, at the end of Sefer Bereishit, we're talking about decades later, when Yaakov is on his deathbed in Mitzrayim. No longer is there any threat from the Canaanite and the Frizi. They're not in Eretz Canaan anymore. First of all, it's been decades and nothing happened, and assumedly what happened back then has been long forgotten. But besides that, he's not even there. He's in Egypt. And his son Yosef is the second Mishneh Lamelech in Egypt. So if he agreed with them but was concerned at the time, one would think that now, if anything, he would retroactively endorse what they did or at least not bring it up. But Yaakov was so angry at Shimon Velevi that on his deathbed, instead of giving them a bracha, he cursed them. And the language of the curse indicates that what he felt that what they did was not only politically dangerous, but also morally wrong. Shimon Velevi Achim, Klei Hamas Mecherotehem. Right? They use the tools of violence. And he says, I distance myself from that and I want no part in what they did. I want to make clear that I am completely condemning and disassociating myself from them. Why? Because they willfully and intentionally killed people. Arur apam, cursed be their anger. Ki az debratam ki kashata. So I think it's clear that Yaakov was opposed to what they did for practical reasons, as he says here, but also for ethical, moral, ideological reasons, as he says later on. And again, there's no problem saying that he had both considerations. By the way, Shimon Velevi, although they expressed it as an ideological principle, perhaps also had it what we would call today a bitchoni, a security argument there as well. In other words, all they said is, what, should we allow our sister to be treated like a prostitute? And they didn't elaborate. So it could mean that what they're saying is to their father, you know, you're afraid that they're going to come and attack us, but I don't care. I'm willing to die over this because I have to defend my sister's honor. Maybe that's what they meant.
Maybe they'll put the fear of God into other people.
Or maybe what their point is, if we allow them to walk all over us like this, we're even more endangered, right? So perhaps they weren't just young, hot-headed, you know, people looking for revenge. Perhaps they were expressing a political, military philosophy. And if that is what they were saying, they might have come to Yaakov later on in his deathbed and say, look, we were right. In the end, you were afraid that this would bring attacks upon us, but did it? The Torah says, by the way, shortly afterwards, that Yaakov's fears were not correct. The opposite was true. The nations of Canaan were afraid of him. They said, whoa, we better not start up with this. These guys are crazy, right? You do one little thing to their sister and they wipe out an entire village. Stay away from them. So maybe there's a security argument to be made in that favor. So maybe we're seeing on both sides, both ideological and practical considerations coming to play. But the point is, if this is all correct, then I've showed you that the debates that we're about to go to the polls in all likelihood and vote about in a few months are just newer, updated versions of a debate that goes back to Yaakov and his sons. And Yaakov, twice, had one consistent approach. And Shimon Velevi represented the opposite approach. So who's right? Well, I know what I think. And you know what you think, whatever that is. But what I just want to show you is that later authorities also continued to have these debates. And later authorities who saw in these parshiot, these things, continued to argue both sides based on what it says here. Let me give you one example. An amazing midrash. A midrash, the significance of which was brought to my attention by a shir I heard many years ago from Rav Yaakov Meidan. The midrash appears in a number of places. I'll read it from Bereishit Rabbah. But the midrash doesn't discuss our parsha here directly. Or at least the beginnings of it are not here. The beginnings of the midrash are discussing an event much, 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 much later on in history, thousands of years later, in the time of Megillat Esther. And we know that it says there in the book of Esther that Haman, there was a law, everyone had to bow to Haman. Umordechai lo yich v'chol avdei hamelech v'asher b'shar melech korim mishtachavim l'haman umordechai lo yichrav lo yishtachavim. And we know that, of course, this is what brought about Haman's anger, v'imalei Haman chema, and ultimately brought about the decree to wipe out v'ashmid l'harogu l'abed et kol yudin minar v'ad zakein taf. I know Hanukkah is in a few weeks. We're not in the mood for Purim right now, but there's a connection. The Midrash, as Midrash does, fills in the details. It says there, Monica, can I just, for 1 second, thanks. So the exact psukim in Esther are the following. This is Esther, Perek Gimel. V'chol avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech korim u'mishtachavim la-haman ki chen tzivalo ha-melech u'morechai lo yichrab lo yishtachavim. Everyone else bows to Haman because that's the law. And Mordechai defies the royal command and refuses to bow. V'yomru avdei ha-melech asher b'shar ha-melech l'mordechai. Madua ata over en mitzvat ha-melech. It says here that the king's servant said to Mordechai, are you crazy? Why are you doing this? Why are you refusing to follow the law? Vahi ki amram elav yom v'yom v'lo shama lehem. For they told, they had this conversation again and again, he refused to listen to them. Vayagidu lehaman lirot hayamdu devrei Mordechai ki gid lehem asher hu yehudi. They told Haman about this to see what would happen because Mordechai had told them that he's a Yehudi. Mordechai had told them that this is why he refused to bow. Vayar Haman ki'ein Mordechai korei mishtachavelo vayimalei Haman chema, etc. So that conversation where the servants of the king asked Mordechai, why aren't you bowing? Mordechai responds that he's a Jew and this gets to Haman, etc. The Midrash kind of fills in the blanks in an imaginary or what we would call Midrashic sort of way to how that conversation took place. And I'll read the version that's in Bereishit Rabbah. Amar Rabbi Levi, b'sha'a she'tziva Achashverosh she'ishtachavu l'haman, hayu akol mishtachavim l'haman chutz mimordechai, she'ne'emar, v'chol avdei ha'melech asher b'shar ha'melech korim mishtachavim l'haman, k'shera'a mordechai she'lo haya mishtachave, amru, shema barbari hu, v'ino ragil b'nimus. When they saw that everyone else was bowing down and Mordechai was, and they said, maybe he's a barbarian, maybe he's just an uncultured person. He doesn't understand the ramifications of what's happening. Hitchilu amru lo mitzvat ha-melechi. Shenemar madu ataver mitzvat ha-melech. So that's why I said, do you understand that we're not just doing this because we feel like it, but this is what's expected and what the king demands? Amar le, Mordechai responded to him, I know exactly what I'm doing. Ani skanter shel ha-kadosh baruch hu. I am a prince. A prince of God. Shene'emar, uvein k'teifav shachim. And when he quotes that, he makes reference not only to his role as a Yehudi, as a member of Am Yisrael, but particularly that he's from Shevet Binyamin. And Shevet Binyamin, it says, vein k'teifav shachim. That God dwells in the territory of Binyamin. Right here, we're in Nachlat Binyamin now. And that's where the Beit HaMikdash was. So Mordechai, as a Jew, first of all, and second of all, as a descendant of Shevet Binyamin, said, I'm a prince of God. I cannot bow to a human being. Amru lo, v'zekeinecha, hishtachavel Esav, hu v'aviv v'achav. And they said to him, but your ancestor Yaakov bowed to Esav, as did all of his children, as did all of his children. So there's precedent for this. Lo katuv, v'tigashna shafot, v'gomer, v'gam liyav, v'chulei. Amar lahem chas v'shalom. Dechtiv achar nigash Yosef v'rachel v'yishtachavu. Ve'adayin lo nolad binyamin. I remember Yaakov made Rav Meidan bang on the table with fire in his eyes. Those who know Rav Meidan know, you know, and saying, you know, my ancestor never bowed to Esav. Everyone else did. Binyamin hadn't been born yet. But Binyamin doesn't bow to Esav. And notice what the Midrash is reading. This Midrash is reading an event from a far distant time and place and reading it back into this story here. Right? And saying the same, Mordechai was faced with the same question. Do you compromise on what you might feel are principles? You know, now one could have had a halachic discussion there, but this isn't a halachic discussion about whether it's permissible to bow to Haman. Was it Avodah Zarah? Wasn't it Avodah Zarah? Pikuach Nefesh, Kain below. That's not what you're talking about here. Right? That's not the way this Midrash is analyzing that event. They're analyzing it ideologically. And Mordechai says a Jew doesn't bow, and certainly not one from Binyamin. And they say to him, but sometimes a Jew does bow. Look at Yaakov. And if you want, Mordechai might respond, perhaps Saba Rabba Yaakov distanced himself from Shimon Velevi? I'm distancing myself from Yaakov. My ancestor didn't bow. I'm not part of that tradition. Now, I don't know if that's what Mordechai was thinking. But that's what the authors of this Midrash are seeing in Mordechai. And they're also seeing the other side. Although at least the way Rav Meidan read this Midrash, it was clear who's right in the Midrash. And I think it's fair to say that's an accurate reading of the Midrash. I'm not sure that... Now when it comes to Shimon V'Levi, there's actually a machloket Rishonim as to whether what Shimon V'Levi did was right or wrong. The Rambam actually provides a halachic justification for what Shimon V'Levi did in eradicating the city of Shechem. In the Rambam, Hilchot Melachim, he discusses, among other topics, what's called the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach. You know, it was the universal laws that apply, the universal Torah laws that apply to all of humanity, not only to Am Yisrael. And one of the things that the halacha says, which is itself somewhat shocking point, but the Gemara does say it, and the Rambam quotes it, is that a Ben Noach meaning a non-Jew, who violates any one of the seven laws that he's obligated to keep, is chayav mita. The penalty is death. Not only for murder or idolatry, but even for theft, for example. Or even for eating eiver min achai. And on that basis, the Rambam, I'm just trying to find the exact source. So one of the seven mitzvot b'nei Noach is called dinim. There are six mitzvot lo taseh, six prohibitions, and one mitzvah aseh, one positive commandment, which is dinim, which is just means laws. And it's not clear exactly what that means, but the Rambam's interpretation of that is, what does it mean? Ketzad, I'm reading here from the Perek Tet Halacha Yud Dalid in Hilchot Melachim. The Ketzad mitzuvin hein ala dinim. What does it mean that they're commanded on dinim? Chayavin lohoshiv dayanim v'shoftim b'chol plach u'plach ladun b'sheish mitzvot eile. The Rambam's understanding of that mitzvah, in contrast with other Rishonim who understand it differently, is that the seventh of the laws of B'nai Noach is that they have to set up a system of courts to enforce the other six laws. And the society as a whole is obligated to set up court system, and assumedly a police force as well, in order to enforce to enforce the laws that and prevent people from murdering or stealing or whatever else is prohibited. Uven Noach she'avar al achad misheva mitzvot eile yehareg b'sayif. And then the Rambam quotes halacha that I just mentioned, which is that if a ben Noach violates any of these seven laws, then he is to be put to death. Umipnei zeh nitchayvu kol ba'alei Shechem hariga. And that's why the entire city of Shechem was deserving of death. Sheharei Shechem gazal. Shechem kidnapped Dina, which is a capital offense. Okay, so Shechem deserves to be killed. What about the rest of the city? And the rest of the city knew what happened, and nobody tried to put him on trial. Nobody objected. Therefore, according to the Rambam, they were all guilty. And therefore, the Rambam is justifying halakhically what Shimon Velevi did. He's providing a justification. Yaakov came along. It's as if the Rambam is taking their side against Yaakov. Yaakov cursed them. He said, you went and killed innocent people. And the Rambam's responding, no, they didn't kill innocent people. They carried out an act of justice against people who... And the Rambam's defending it. He's defending it here on a legal basis. But we can then take that and come and now say... He's endorsing what they did ideologically, so to speak. The Ramban, on this parsha here, the Ramban quotes this Rambam and attacks him and says it's not good. First of all, he goes through halakhic analysis. He disagrees with the Rambam's entire analysis and he says you're not chayav misa for that. And so first of all, he pulls the rug out from under the Rambam's legal justification. And he gives a whole different explanation. And it sounds to me like the Ramban is on Yaakov's side. Let me just read it to you. Aval inyan Shechem, ki b'nei Yaakov bavur shahiyu anshei Shechem rishayim, v'damam chashuv lahem kamayim. In the eyes of b'nei Yaakov, the people in Shechem were evil people and their blood is like water. They saw no problem killing them. And they felt that everyone is guilty. B'Yaakov amar lehem b'kan ki evyu b'sakana. And he explains how Yaakov was upset. But he wants to know, why did Yaakov go along with it until now? Because it must have been clear to Yaakov what they were planning. It seems like there was some kind of a conspiracy. And Yaakov knew all about it. So he goes through and he says that... That Yaakov didn't understand exactly what their plan was. And that Yaakov, I can't find the exact line, so I'll just tell you outside. That Yaakov thought one of two things. First of all, that Yaakov assumed that the people of Shechem wouldn't agree to the Brit Milah, and then he'd have an excuse. We made it. In other words, he's using diplomacy, right? They come along and say, we want to get married. We want to have this marriage. Shimon Velevi came up with this idea of Brit Milah. And Yaakov thought, oh, that's a great idea, because now I'm going to have an excuse, a diplomatic excuse, to get out of it. Or that Yaakov thought, well, what if they do agree? Then they'll be weak on the third day. But not that they can go in and kill everybody. They'll be able to go in and rescue Dina. Maybe kill Shechem and Hamor. But that Yaakov had no idea that there was a plan to wipe out the entire city, and that is what he distanced himself from. And the Ramban sounds like he's on Yaakov's side. So here you have it. Here you have it. We have Rambam and Ramban in the Middle Ages taking the two sides of Yaakov and his sons. One more source. And this is a source that perhaps I could... I quoted a midrash, you know, on the right-wing side of things. Perhaps you could read this on the left-wing side of things. But I think both sides can find some comfort in this. The Sefer HaChinuch on this week's Parsha. There are three mitzvot in the entire book of Bereshit. Really, the mitzvot, I think we've talked about this at one point, that the mitzvot in the Torah really begin in the book of Shemot. But there are three mitzvot scattered around in the book of Bereshit, and the third of them is in this week's parsha. It's the mitzvah of refraining from eating the gid hanasheh, right? A certain part of the animal. And that's related, of course, to that story that we skipped earlier, which we don't have time to read now either. But as we know, Yaakov confronted this angelic being on the night before he met Esav. The rabbis refer to that angelic being as the spiritual representative of Esav. And they wrestled all night. And it ends, Vayarki lo yacholo vayiga b'chaf yerecho vateka kaf yerek Yaakov behayavko imo. Yaakov, he wasn't able to defeat Yaakov, this angelic being, but he managed to wound Yaakov in his leg, and Yaakov was wounded, and then it says afterwards, Vayizrach lo ha-shemesh kasher avar p'nuev hu tzolea al yerecho. In the morning, Yaakov was limping. He was wounded in his leg, and therefore he was limping. Al kain lo yochlu bnei Yisrael et gid hanasheh asher al kaf hayarech ad yom hazeh. And therefore, that gid hanasheh, that certain part of the leg in an animal, is something that we're not allowed to eat in memory of the fact that Yaakov was wounded in that part of his leg. Sefer Achinuch. That's a mitzvah. Ad yom hazeh. It's a mitzvah deoraita. Ashkenazic Jews for a long time didn't eat the entire back half of the animal because. Now, but if you are going to eat it, you have to have someone who knows how to remove the Gid HaNasheh. So, the Sefer HaChinuch, his approach on every mitzvah in the Torah, is he tries to give you the rationale, the meaning behind the mitzvah, the idea, Ta'amei HaMitzvah, or what he calls Shorshei HaMitzvah. And he asks, what's the idea behind the mitzvah of Gid HaNasheh? I understand, Yaakov was wounded, and there's a Gid HaNasheh, and therefore, why does that mean that we shouldn't eat the Gid HaNasheh? The factual connection between that object, the Gid HaNasheh, and this event is clear, but what's the meaning of the mitzvah? Why are we not supposed to eat it? He says, Kedesh Tia Remez Li Yisrael. It's meant to be a hint to us. Sha'afal Pishi Yisbelu Tzarot Rabot Begaluyot Miyar Hamim Miyar Bnei Esav Yubetuchim Shelo Yavdu. We should be encouraged whenever we suffer and our enemies, the descendants of Esav and others are attacking us, that we should draw strength from this and know that we're going to be okay. V'remez zehu lefi shoto malach shenocham im Yaakov avinu sheba b'kabalah she'asarosh elekav ratzal la'akrol Yaakov min olam v'lo yacholo. Just like Yaakov was wounded and he survived, so too we're going to survive. I always found this to be strange on two levels. First of all, I understand that the Torah wanted to memorialize that event to give us encouragement. That's what the Sefer HaChinuch says, to give us encouragement that if we're ever in a situation like Yaakov was, where we feel like all is lost, Ki yarei anochi oto pen yavov yirkani eim al banim, if we're ever in such a situation, we should know, Yaakov, what's the Israeli expression? Avarnu et paro navor gam et zeh? Right? So avarnu et esav navor gam et zeh, we should know. That part I get. But two things I don't get. One, why is the symbol chosen the Gid HaNasheh? That's a symbol of the fact that Esav managed to hurt Yaakov. If you want to show me that Yaakov was saved, right, number one. And number two, why is the mitzvah lotaseh? Maybe the mitzvah should be to eat the Gid HaNasheh, if that's going to be the symbol, to do something. Why are we refraining from something? And so I'll close with this thought. If you're of left-wing leanings, you can certainly see encouragement in this, but I'm of right-wing leanings, I see encouragement in it too. I think the point was, Yaakov survived, yes, even though he was wounded. Yes. And we remember the fact that Yaakov was wounded. And Yaakov's approach was to be passive. Because he felt that, and how did Yaakov survive Esav? Simply by sticking it out. When there was nothing else to do, he just stuck it out. And that's what Yaakov survived, and that's the message of the Gid HaNasheh according to Sefer HaChinuch. In conclusion, I think what we see here is two things. First of all, the political debates are valid, and the Torah addresses them, but the Torah provides room for both, and therefore the debate remains valid. And if that's true, the second point is perhaps there's some degree of truth to both, and whatever position we take perhaps needs to be tempered with the fact that there is another side. And whether you go for Doron or Milchama, it should be accompanied by Tfilah. And that perhaps is the ultimate message of the Gid HaNasheh.